Good evening, everyone. My name is Ayça Çubukçu. I'm assistant professor in human rights at the London School of Economics and Political Science and the director of its human rights program. On behalf of LSE Human Rights, I'm delighted to welcome you to the school and introduce our speaker tonight, Professor Neve Gordon. I'm sure that Professor Gordon will be addressing the events unfolding in Gaza today and yesterday, but the topic of today's lecture is based on a book he has written called The Human Right to Dominate, which he has co-authored with Dr. Nicola Perugini. The Human Right to Dominate was published by Oxford University Press in 2015 and followed Professor Gordon's first book, Israel's Occupation, which was published by the University of California Press in 2008. Having previously taught at Ben-Gurion University, Professor Gordon is currently Marie Curie Fellow and Professor of International Law at Queen Mary University of London. He has been a member of the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton and visiting scholar at numerous universities in the United States, including Berkeley, Brown University, the University of Michigan, and in London, he was also a visiting scholar recently at SOAS. Professor Gordon's current research focuses on the history and politics of human shielding. He is interested in the role of international law in producing an ethics of violence and how the production of new legal subjects, such as human shields, unlawful combatants, and enemies killed in action, facilitate the construction of an ethics that is conducive to specific actors. In addition to being a political theorist, Professor Gordon is a public intellectual who contributes frequently to publications such as the London Review of Books, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, the Nation, the Guardian, Haaretz, the Jerusalem Post, the Chicago Tribune, Counterpunch, and the Boston Globe. Professor Gordon's lecture tonight is organized by the Internationalism, Cosmopolitanism, and the Politics of Solidarity research group that I convene at LSE, and I would like to thank Emma Glassie of the Department of Sociology there in the back for the work she has put into putting the event together tonight. Before we proceed, allow me to note that this event is being audio recorded. Technology permitting, we hope to have a podcast of the event available next week. Audience members are welcome and encouraged to tweet about the event by using the hashtag LSE Human Rights. Tonight, Professor Gordon will speak for about an hour and will try to leave plenty of time for questions and answers from the audience, but we'll conclude sharply at 7:30 p.m. It's a pleasure and honor indeed to welcome to LSE Professor Gordon. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming him. Thank you.
Thanks, Ayça. Thank you for inviting me. I think it's my first time giving a lecture here. Should I save this?
Yeah.
Just shrink it. Okay. So it's really a pleasure to be here. And thank you, Ayça, for inviting me and so forth. Yesterday was an extremely sad day. I think 58 or 59 Palestinian protesters were killed, and about over 2,000 were injured, some of them critically, in the protest in Gaza Strip, which is basically the world's biggest open prison. Today is 70 years to the Nakba, and the protest has been a part of a series of protests, protesting the conditions of the people in Gaza, and demanding a right to leave this prison and a return to their land. Israel has been blaming these protesters of using children as human shields. Aisha told you that my current research is on human shielding. So basically what Israel has been doing, and the IDF through its Twitter account and blog has been sending these video clips showing that in the protests, sometimes there's children among the protesters, and saying that the Palestinians use human shields. Now, what is a human shield? A human shield, according to international law, is a civilian that has protected status that shields a military target. So by blaming the Palestinian protesters of using human shields, Israel is basically admitting that the protesters are a military target. So unarmed protesters are military targets. When I go to protests in Israel and here in London, and I've gone to a few protests here in London, and I've gone to maybe hundreds in Israel, I've often taken my children with me. I think it's good way to raise children, to teach them that there's concerns that they're not only their own, there's political concerns. And I wouldn't want to be blamed for using my children as human shields, and I haven't been blamed for using my children as human shields because I've never been a military target. Now, this is one incident that I'll talk about today. I won't talk about human shields, though, about how international law and how human rights law is used by the strong in order to dominate the weak. We usually think of human rights as a weapon of the weak for struggles for social justice and struggles for emancipation, but that is not always the case. Now, the Nakba, we say that the Palestinians are commemorating the Nakba now, 70 years after the event. But the crucial point is, as the late Edward Said already taught us years ago, is that the Nakba is not an event. It's a structure and a process, meaning that it continues on. Now, Nakba in English is catastrophe, and what it symbolizes for the Palestinians is a tragic moment in history where 750,000 out of approximately 900 or 950,000 Palestinians that lived in what became Israel were either expelled or fled from that territory, and their land was confiscated. And what we see in Israel today, and what I will touch upon briefly today, is how this kind of act of dispossession from your land, from Palestinian land, continues to today. And that's what is meant by the Nakba not being an event, but a structure or process. But what I will also show you today, and this is what in a way is counterintuitive and maybe, for me at least, is a bit fascinating, is how human rights is mobilized for this continued structure and process, for continuing the Nakba. So I'll talk about 40 minutes, and then we'll open it up for questions and discussion. But my background is actually theory, political theory. And what I'll begin is, I won't begin with Israel-Palestine. I'll begin with some major claims and other incidents around the world. to kind of expose my thesis about how human rights is being deployed, are being deployed today across the globe. Then I'll zoom in to Israel-Palestine to kind of show you how it is being used there to take over and to take control, mostly now, of Bedouin land in the Israeli Negev. And finally, I'll end the lecture by asking, okay, if human rights are now a weapon of the strong, is there any way, what remains from human rights? Is there any way they can be salvaged and used for struggles for social justice? So let me begin. On a cool spring day in May 2012, the members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, met in Chicago. The 28 heads of state comprising the military alliance had come to the Windy City to discuss the Arab Spring, a missile shield system for Europe, and the withdrawal of NATO troops from Afghanistan. As some of you may remember, not long before the Chicago summit, President Obama publicly declared that the U.S. would begin pulling out its troops from Afghanistan and that a full withdrawal would be achieved by 2014. NATO was therefore set to decide how this withdrawal would take place. However, a few days before the summit began, placards appeared in the bus stops around downtown Chicago urging NATO not to withdraw its forces from Afghanistan, but to keep them there. NATO, keep the progress going, read the poster, creating a very clear connection between the military occupation of Afghanistan and progress. The caption was spread over a photograph of two Afghani women walking in an unrecognizable street wearing burqas that cover their entire body, including their face. Walking between them is a girl who seems surprised by the voyeuristic photographer. Hers is the only visible face which looks neither frightened nor happy, but is nonetheless alert. The photograph subtext seems clear. Unless there is Western intervention, the burqa is this child's future. Connecting the caption with the image, one understands that according to the logic of the placard, NATO needs to continue its mission in Afghanistan in order to emancipate Afghani women, particularly Afghani girls. Indeed, military resolve and even violence is needed to ensure these women's rights. Just in case the viewer happened to miss the connection, on the top left-hand side of the poster, one reads in large, bold letters, "Human Rights for Women and Girls in Afghanistan." The poster was part of a public campaign against President Obama's declared intention of withdrawing U.S. troops from U.S. and NATO troops from Afghanistan. Under the banner "NATO Keep the Progress Going," there was a notification of a shadow summit for Afghan women, which was to take place alongside the NATO summit. Sponsoring the event was not a Republican think tank or a military corporation, but Amnesty International, the first and most renowned human rights organization across the globe. The idea that the most prominent international human rights NGO was campaigning the U.S. government and NATO in order to stop them from withdrawing their military forces from a country halfway across the globe is worth dwelling upon. The underlying assumption of the Amnesty campaign is that violence protects human rights from the violence that violates human rights. Violence and human rights are not antithetical. Amnesty's campaign is fascinating because it implores a group of states to deploy violence and prolong a foreign military occupation in order to defend women from radical Islam. The historically complex political situation in Afghanistan is thus reduced to religion-driven human rights violations against which protracted violence intervention is needed. The campaign against the withdrawal of NATO troops from Afghanistan is merely a paradigmatic example of a much wider trend whereby human rights are being deployed in the service of domination. If during the 1980s and 1990s, conservatives tended to reject the expanding human rights culture and were even often hostile to it, at the turn of the new millennium, they began to alter their strategy, embracing human rights language. This shift is part of a global phenomenon. In fact, there are many parallels to be drawn between the use of women's rights by the Bush administration to justify the war in Afghanistan, the use of women's rights by Marine Le Pen today in France to justify anti-immigrant, mostly Muslim immigrant policies, the use of human rights and gay rights by Geert Wilders, in the head of the conservative, the Freedom Party in Holland, to justify banning the Quran and other Muslim religious texts, again, in the name of gay rights and women's rights. Human rights discourse has become a desired resource for those seeking political influence and power, providing its diverse advocates legitimacy for their struggles in an aura of respectability that no other rhetoric can apply. These appropriations, whereby human rights have become the new lingua franca of global moral speak, underscore that human rights have been increasingly serving as a common horizon for political traditions of different stripes. Their widespread deployment as a dominant and moral currency has also propelled institutional change, whereby conservatives began to introduce the language and strategies of human rights within existing organizations, while simultaneously creating an array of new human rights NGOs, which until recently seemed to be the sole turf of liberals. In the US, well-established conservative tanks have become home to scholars with expertise that include human rights, while a plethora of conservative NGOs are now invoking human rights to advance their political objectives. Indeed, a spate of conservative NGOs have adopted the human rights agenda and are now not only mirroring the language of rights and its institutional scaffolding, but also the methodologies and strategies that liberal human rights organizations have developed over the years. Advocacy campaigns that name and shame perpetrators of abuse are no longer the prerogative of liberal human rights organizations which developed these strategies in the 70s and 80s. While the invocation of international human rights and international humanitarian law, once the signature of liberal human rights organizations, such as the International Commission of Jurists and the American Civil Liberties Union, now appear in petitions filed by the conservative Rutherford Institute, the National Rifle Association, and the American Center for Justice and Law. The appropriation of human rights language, institutions, and strategies of conservative actors points to an increasing convergence between liberals and conservatives on a global scale. Significantly, the condition of possibility of these convergences are a mutual agreement on some fundamental assumption. So basically, the fact that they both can use the human rights language tells me that there is some agreement between them on other issues as well. First, both liberal and conservative human rights NGOs share certain juridical assumptions about law's authority, the court's decisive role as the arbiter of disagreement, and what constitutes adequate language to discuss evidence, in this case, the legal vocabulary of human rights. Second, during the past decade, liberal and conservative human rights NGOs have adopted increasingly similar strategies of human rights advocacy. This form of convergence includes an agreement on the appropriate methodology and techniques for gathering data, what constitutes valid data, and constantly what constitutes evidence. Third, both liberals and conservatives use the evidence of human rights abuses to generate meaning and allocate guilt and innocence. So basically, if we look today at what's going on in Gaza, then each side will use human rights to allocate guilt and innocence. We'll use the same language. Each side will say that their rights have been abused. Each side will say that they are the victims in this kind of conflict. Such convergences suggest that human rights lawyers, activists, and experts representing a variety of organizations with different objectives ultimately share assumptions about the predominant role of the law and about certain methodological standards that need to be satisfied for the data to actually produce evidence. Hence, it is no surprise that they often use similar strategies to advance their objectives. We define the deployment of the same strategies by different organizations as mirroring. I want to show you something. How do I do this? Let's do it like... Is there a keyboard? Okay, so, I mean, this might have been obvious to some of you, this poster, but this is mirroring, okay? Because the two boys there are not Palestinians, they are Jewish settlers, okay? So it's a mirroring of the Palestinian anti-colonial project, and the anti-colonialists here are the Jewish settlers, and we'll get back to that in a moment. Liberals and conservatives from different geographical areas aiming to advance different political goals mirror each other in numerous ways. These include the way they formulate the petitions submitted to the courts, the invocation of international law in these petitions, the kind of advocacy campaigns they launch, and even the iconography they use. So, what we see is, for example, the burqa is now used. We saw it, how it was used in the Amnesty International campaign. And this is a campaign by a Frankfurt human rights organization against Muslim migrants, okay? So it's a conservative campaign that's using exactly the same symbols that Amnesty used. So we see how basically the messages are very similar. Again, a referendum a successful referendum against minarets in Switzerland using the same symbols as Amnesty used. So we see how people with diametrically opposed political views, basically, or at least seemingly diametrically opposed political views, are using the same symbols to advance very different messages. Due to the diverse political proclivities of these groups, we are not only witness convergences and mirrorings, but also inversions. Organizations with different political agendas struggling around the same moral dilemmas launch uncannily similar types of campaigns articulated through the language of human rights, but the ideals and belief these campaigns convey may be radically different. So the two boys on the cover of our book is a case of inversion, okay? It's a mirroring that inverses the power relations. In the U.S., the Q Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, and we've seen the massacres in the U.S. in the past years, invokes human rights against the widespread circulation of weapons and ensuing massacres, while the National Rifle Association depicts gun owners as the persecuted minority, victims of human rights violations. These inversions help expose that human rights, which most people assume to be progressive and liberating, can just as easily be connected with domination. This is not to say that the relation between human rights and domination is new. It isn't. But rather that it has become much more apparent as soon as the new appropriations we are describing become pervasive across the globe. Now, there are several reasons why we're currently witnessing the proliferation of human rights appropriations. One of these has to do with the larger politics of managing consent and dissent at home and abroad, where by the deployment of human rights by conservative think tanks, NGOs, and philanthropy organizations is part of a response to the perceived success of liberals in advancing their policy objectives. Another reason for the increasing appropriation has to do with the efficacy of human rights in framing history. The appropriations informing the inversions we mentioned and those from Israel-Palestine, which I will explore in a minute, reflect a struggle over the narration of history, or more precisely, the struggle over the interpretation of history of violence as dominations. Rights, as Duncan Kennedy points out, are extremely poignant because their invocation allows you to be right about your value judgment rather than just stating preferences. They frame events legally and morally and ultimately help legitimize certain interpretations of domination while delegitimizing others. Now, human rights are no doubt tools, or there's a new book coming out saying they are weapons to advance political goals. But in the process of being appropriated, they do much more. They become an organic part of a social and political text, and not only a pretext for some other hidden objective. In this respect, there's no fundamental difference between the liberal and conservative appropriation of human rights, since both camps adopt the same reasoning. They appropriate human rights to develop a legal and moral framework in which historical events and political objectives are given a specific meaning. In this way, human rights help produce a certain narration of history which simultaneously confers a specific political meaning on human rights themselves. Human rights, in other words, constitute a highly flexible political discourse with the capacity to be constantly appropriated, translated, performed, and retooled for different political interests in different political arenas. It is within such process that the relationship between human rights and domination reveals itself. Now, what liberals often say is that the conservatives are basically distorting human rights. My claim is that this is wrong. The conservatives are using human rights in a very similar way to the liberals, and the liberals don't have ownership over human rights. So it's not a critique, what I'm saying, about a distorted way of using human rights. This is how human rights are used by both liberals and conservative. And this is what I call the politics of human rights. By the politics of human rights, I mean the struggle over the translation and interpretation of human rights, not as pretext, but as text, whereby diverse actors integrate the grammar of human rights within their own worldview, while their worldview in turn is informed by this integration of human rights. In other words, the rhetoric of human rights is both a political tool And just as importantly, an epistemic framework that shapes the way different actors conceive their own position within social space and the political significance of events that they witness or are concerned about. So what I'm going to now do is turn to Israel-Palestine and to provide you one example of how human rights and domination have been converging in order to advance the dispossession of the Bedouin population in the Negev. Now, although this process is relevant to a variety of right-wing organizations, I will focus on one new human rights NGO called Revagavim. And by way of conclusion, I'll offer some suggestions how we might retool human rights in order to transform them into a potent weapon of resistance. Regavim, the National Land Protection Trust, was established in 2005. Regavim's main objective is to Judaize the land, and it is using human rights discourse to advance its goals. So, Israel's population is 8.5 million today. Among them, there's 20% Palestinian citizens. The citizens are those that live in the red and the yellow, not in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Those Palestinians are stateless and do not hold citizens. Also, the Palestinians, about 300,000, I think, in East Jerusalem are not citizens. Palestinian municipal jurisdiction inside Israel, so they're 20% of the population. They controlled, the Jews controlled before 1948, 8% of the land. Today, Palestinian municipal jurisdiction in Israel is 2.7% of the land. The Negev, the red part, Nakab in Arabic, is 55% of Israel's land, 14% of the population. Within the Negev, one-third, so the Negev is about 650,000 people, 230,000 are Palestinian Bedouin, and 65,000 live in what's called unrecognized villages. Regavim refers to these villages as outpost. But outpost is a word used to refer to what's called illegal settlements in the West Bank. Jewish settlements in the West Bank that are illegal, as if the other ones are legal, which is a problem in itself. But these Jewish settlements are referred to as outposts. So what Regavim does is exactly takes the language and uses it to describe the unrecognized Bedouin villages where 65,000 people live. Unlike the Jewish outposts in the West Bank, Israeli law forbids Bedouins living in these villages from connecting to the electricity grid or the water, sewage, and sewage systems. Construction regulations are harshly enforced, and in 2015 alone, about 1,000 Bedouin homes and animal pens, usually referred to by the government as structures, were demolished. This is part of an unrecognized Bedouin village. There are no paved roads to the villages. The villages are not shown on official maps. So you buy a map of Israel, you want to drive your car, you open your Google Maps, whatever you do, these villages do not exist. They're erased from the landscape on the map. As a matter of official administrative geography, the places inhabited by these citizens of Israel who live under constant threat of dispossession do not exist. This is how Regavim characterized these people, the people you see in the picture here, and the villages. On this battlefield, the organization explains, cement mixers have replaced tanks, plows replace cannons, and innocent-looking civilians replace uniformed soldiers. Acre after acre house after house, buying, squatting, illegally cultivating the soil that is not theirs, sometimes with guile, other times with violence, with huge sums of money and firmly backed by anti-Zionist organizations in Israel and abroad, Israel is losing its hold on the Jewish people's land. It's almost poetic, okay? But basically, what we just saw a minute ago is this, okay? The Gavim's campaign constructs a reality rooted in settler and colonial erasures. By displacing Palestinian history and geography and replacing it with a Zionist imaginary, the NGO produces a series of inversions in order to legitimize its claims of justice. The novelty of its approach is that it uses the language of human rights to advance colonial settler goals. So settler colonialism has been is not new. Israel is in no way the inventor. What's new about the phenomena that I'm describing is how the settler colonialist describes what it is doing through the language of human rights. And this language, is the novelty of its approach is that it uses the language of human rights to advance colonial settler goals. The lack, and this is a quote, the lack of law enforcement and the discrimination in favor of Palestinians are, in Regavim's view, placing the foundation of Israeli state and the democratic principle of legal equality at risk by fostering the dispossession of Jews. So the dispossessed now is the Jew, okay? In order to carry out this strategy, they're doing exactly what we mentioned before. They're appropriating the language of human rights, mirroring the strategies of the liberal human rights organizations while inverting the relations of power. And as they're doing it, they're carrying out settler erasures. And what I'd like to do now is to show you exactly how this is done. Okay, but what we see here is how human rights has become the weapon of the strong. Mirroring B'Tselem's report on how settler violence is treated with impunity. So B'Tselem is a liberal human rights organization. It publishes reports about how settlers, Jewish settlers in the West Bank, carry out violent acts against Palestinians in the West Bank, uprooting their trees, beating them, sometimes shooting them, and how the law enforcement in Israel allows these settlers to walk free. They can do these acts with impunity, okay? So this is what the liberal human rights organization does. It tracks these settlers as they carry out these violent acts, shows that the law enforcement responsible for bringing them to justice does not do its work. Mirroring B'Tselem's reports on how settler violence is treated with impunity in some of its petitions, Rekavim emphasizes the lack of law enforcement as a human rights argument. So it says there's a lack of law enforcement. In every given moment in Israel, there's about 40,000 demolition orders against houses owned by Palestinian citizens of Israel. 40,000. And as I showed you, or as I said before, in 2015, in 2016, each year, Israel demolished 1,000 Bedouin homes in each year. And they had a demolition order because they are illegal. What Regavim does is it goes to the High Court of Justice and it sues the state. And it says that the state is not enforcing the law. There's 40,000 demolition orders. Why aren't you demolishing more? Okay? So it files a petition against, like the B'Tselem, that files a petition against the law enforcement that are not bringing these settlers to justice when they commit violence against the Palestinians. suing the state, suing the police, which is an organ of the state. Regavim sues the state for not demolishing more Palestinian houses. In other circumstances, Regavim does not, this is a demolished Bedouin home. In other circumstances, Regavim does not build on pending demolition orders, but submits its own petitions asking the government to demolish Palestinian houses. In one such petition, the language of human rights intertwines with the international rhetoric of environmental protection. So basically, I'll talk this instead of reading it. Basically, there's a charcoal factory, okay? A Palestinian charcoal factory. And what the Regavim says, the factory is illegal and that it basically is hurting the Jewish children nearby because of the pollution that comes out of the factory. And so it's using environmental rights to demand the demolition of a Palestinian factory. Okay? Describing Regavim's petitions to the High Court of Justice, Dror Etkes, a liberal human rights activist, underscore how convergences in the strategy of mirroring manifest themselves in the legal arena. So this is a Supreme Court appeal, Regavim versus Prime Minister Netanyahu et al. So it's suing the state, right? And this is what Dror Etkes says about it, the liberal human rights person. And I'm quoting, it's a copy-paste of our petitions. I'm not a lawyer, I'm not the one writing the petitions, but they are copy-pasting parts of the petitions, changing names. Instead of settler outposts, they call a Bedouin village an illegal outpost. One should note that this copy-paste is not merely a mirroring of human... So basically, they go take a petition from the Association for Civil Rights in Israel, copy it, change a few names, change a few details, and sue the state over something totally different. So it's a totally mirroring, using the human rights language, the international conventions and international law in these petitions. But this is not merely a mirroring of a human rights strategy, but also denotes a convergence of belief about what constitutes a valid technique, what is legitimate evidence, and what constitutes the legal foundations of petitions. So if we return for a moment to the silent conquest, who's carrying out the conquest? The Bedouins are carrying out the conquest, right? Again, the silent conquest campaign against the Bedouin, the organization maintains that Israel has until now offered Bedouin carrots, but completely lacked a stick, claiming also that through their criminal activity, the Bedouin are colonizing the land, threatening to put an end to the Jewish future of the southern region. So the power dynamics, if you read this report and you come from Mars, you think the Bedouin are these strong people, they're having this silent conquest, they're taking over the land and putting an end to the Jewish future in the southern region. I mean, they are threatening. The very existence of a Palestinian Bedouin in the arena constitutes a form of colonialism and an existential threat to the state. In this way, the organization Human Rights Discourse constructs a very particular meaning of indigenousness and completely inverts the history of settler colonial dispossession to which the Jewish state has continuously subjected Palestinians in the Negev and elsewhere. In a 2014 report entitled The Truth About the Negev Bedouin, Regavim claims that the Palestinians Bedouins do not fulfill, and I'm quoting, the world's accepted criteria for being considered indigenous, and that discrimination against them by the state of Israel is a myth. The NGO refers to the work of three scholars who define Palestinian claims of indigenousness as, and I quote, a fabrication of history. thus revealing the contribution of the Israeli Academy to the settler human rights discourse. So we see here an alliance between this NGO and different academics. Crafting the indigenous presence as an invasion and couching the settler as native are two interrelated discursive operations that are made possible by the ambivalent nature of colonial power. So there's a political theorist, Homi Bhabha, that tells us that the native constantly wants to emulate the colonizer. But what we see in Israel is how the colonizer wants to emulate the indigenous, the colonized, okay? What is unique about the Israeli case is that the articulation of this inversion is carried out through the human rights discourse. The colonizer's nativeness can, so to speak, be achieved only through a process whereby the colonized is framed as an invader and as such a violator of human rights. In other words, the colonized native, in our case, the Palestinian Bedouin, is transformed into a colonizer who, through acts of dispossession, breaches the human rights of the Israeli Jew. Then this inversion exposes the ultimate political objectives of settler human rights NGOs and, by extension, the colonial logic of the state. The moral economy in which all this is being played out, read this, it's kind of fascinating, is being played out is thus grounded in a specific idea of the state, the Jewish and democratic state of Israel. Both the liberal and conservative NGOs make demands of the state from a presumed position of opposition, each one calling upon the state to abide by a certain moral frame. The liberal NGOs have tried to rectify the excesses arising from the state's Jewish character, aspiring to make the government adhere to their conception of liberal democracy and universalist principles, but without challenging the notion of a Jewish state in which the dispossession and dehumanization of the Palestinians is rooted. So even the liberal human rights have nothing to say about the Jewish character of the state. The conservative NGOs are pushing the government to adhere to its ethnocratic commitments to the Jewish polity on which the state is founded. In this way, dispossessing the non-Jews is elevated to an act of self-defense and ultimately justice. This is how human rights are being adopted and used in Israel-Palestine by one representative settler organization. By way of conclusion, I would like to briefly examine how we have reached a situation where conservative organizations use human rights to deepen Israel's colonial project, and how liberal rights groups such as Amnesty International can use human rights to protest against the withdrawal of military troops from Afghanistan. Now, some of you are students of human rights here. I'm a professor of human rights. I'm going to be very critical now of human rights, so get ready. How and why has a potent weapon that in the past was deployed as a tool of resistance, emancipation, and social justice been transformed in different arenas across the globe, either for treating the symptoms of structural abuse or as a vehicle to enhance domination? And this is, I think, what human rights do today. They either treat symptoms or are a vehicle of a domination. Now, my claim in the book is that the rise of settler human rights organizations such as Regavim is tied to a process whereby human rights have been subordinated to a certain legal and methodological framework that alienates the very people whose rights are being violated while crucially abandoning any demand for structural change. This alienation and lack of structural critique are also two points where liberal and conservative human rights organizations tend to converge and mirror each other. The adoption of this framework, as several scholars have pointed out, is related to the NGOization of human rights. So my students, I ask my students that come and do a degree in human rights, what do you want to do you know, when you graduate, and 98% say they want to work in an NGO. I worked in an NGO, okay, too, before I went to academia, and they want to work in an NGO. And so this critique is about the what I call the NGOization of human rights. So sorry. In Israel-Palestine, it is important to keep in mind that human rights first entered the political scene not through the work of NGOs, but as a powerful popular discourse adopted by hundreds of thousands of Palestinians to counter Israel's systematic policies of dispossession. When the first Intifada erupted in 1987, protesters in the occupied Palestinian territories filled the streets demonstrating against Israeli colonial rule and denouncing the systematic violation of human rights. The shared goal of many Palestinians who drew on the human rights discourse and made it an integral part of their revolt was to unveil the oppressive character of the occupying forces and to undercut all attempts to present the occupation as normal. They claimed the human right to rebel against an oppressive regime. Human rights were thus adopted as the language with which to spearhead the struggle for self-determination. Not long after the emergence, their emergence as an integral part of the public discourse in Israel-Palestine, human rights became institutionalized. So I was the first director of Physicians for Human Rights Israel. This is during the first Intifada. I'm a bit older than I look. In any case, what happened then, in 2 years, we have 20 new human rights NGOs. So in Israel, there was one human rights NGO before the Intifada, and within 2 years, you have about 20. In the Palestinian territories, there was two human rights NGOs before the Intifada. Within a year, you have about 8 more, okay? So what you have is this NGOization of human rights. So they take this popular discourse that was there, by that time a discourse on the global terrain, they bring it in. I did a study of Israeli newspapers in Hebrew of when the human rights discourse entered public language in Israel. So the Palestinians brought human rights to Israel through their protest in the First Intifada. That's when it enters the public domain, and suddenly we have a plethora of new human rights NGOs. And this is where the curse begins. And I'm part of this curse. I was active in it, I was so forth. These NGOs introduced different human rights practices and a new ideology, much more in line with the global trends of professionalization than with the spirit of the Intifada and the local political challenges of decolonization. Human rights were no longer used to criticize Israel's colonial project as such, but the rights discourse was limited to critiquing some of its manifestations. While it is certainly important to note that over the years, these organizations have had a number of successful campaigns, human rights organizations in Israel-Palestine have nonetheless also been responsible for converting the human rights into a legalistic discourse, one informed by a top-down approach where those who are violated and abused very often have no hand or say in their own emancipation. The institutionalization of human rights in the wake of the First Intifada ultimately undermined efforts by the people to continue using them as part of their own popular mobilization, unmooring them from the very people who have been subjected to daily violation. From a tool of the masses, human rights were transformed into a tool of the experts. And while initially the experts were liberals, today, many conservative organizations like Regavim have among their staff human rights experts. In fact, one of the main effects of the professionalization of human rights has been the creation of a social class authorized to define and legitimize the boundaries of human rights activism. Which language can be used when struggling for human rights? Which techniques are effective? Which fora and courts are appropriate? And who has the legitimacy to invoke human rights in public? This class of experts ultimately shapes the political field of human rights by determining the fundamental conditions that grant access to the debate, while conferring the right to speak human rights only to a select few. Simultaneously, to become a human rights professional, one also has to assume the appearance of neutrality, as if the claims made are determined by your universal, namely non-political, legal norms. So you have to be depoliticized in order to adopt this language. Indeed, legal fundamentalism, neutrality, and a lack of interest in popular mobilization are all part of the same process. The crisis of human rights in this and other contexts of profound injustice is accordingly due to their deployment in a way that is non-threatening to the powers that be. So there's also, we see this in other terrains, so there's also a feminism today, what my partner calls neoliberal feminism, that's not threatening. Hillary Clinton's a feminist, and Theresa May's a feminist, everyone's a feminist. And so the same thing has been done with human rights. You created a language of human rights that is not threatening. And the question, my question, is how do we make human rights threatening again? How do we produce the threat of human rights? How do we reconnect contemporary human rights struggles to those emancipatory legacies, anti-colonialism, anti-apartheid, anti-slavery, which have for the most part been erased by today's NGOized orthodoxy? How do we repoliticize human rights after they have been hijacked by professionals? So in the last 2 minutes, I'd like to offer three suggestions on how to counter this trend. I'm trying to redeem human rights. I don't know if it's a good idea, but I'll try anyway. First, I believe that it's vital to adopt and disseminate a popular human rights discourse. This does not mean that human rights should be mobilized in a way that ignores the law. On the contrary, I believe that activists can and should appropriate the language of human rights to target the law where and where the law enhances domination, and often the law enhances domination, as Marx taught us. If the use of the law confers legitimacy on existing repressive structures, then a short circuit has to be created, combining human rights with other political discourses and practices of emancipation in order to undo the law legitimacy nexus. Second, if the professionalization of human rights NGOs has profoundly impoverished human rights, we need to begin thinking seriously about ways to deprofessionalize human rights. This entails broadening human rights beyond their legalistic interpretations and the accompanying professional culture, and dissolving the boundaries in which the contemporary political field of human rights is crystallized. Insofar as the politics of human rights are currently shaped through the creation of a privileged classes of practitioners and intellectuals who are granted more authority and legitimacy to speak human rights than others, and particularly those who suffer most from violation, I mean, then these class differences should be abolished. This can be carried out through institutional change, either by completely reshaping NGOs in order to make them accountable to people they came to represent. So Human Rights Watch director Kenneth Roth has been the director for, I think, almost 25 years. Okay? Like Mugabe. So we need to democratize human rights by establishing totally different institutions that are more aligned and accountable to the grassroots movements. This leads me to my final consideration. When the existing forms of human rights mobilizations do not challenge or help to undo domination in a given context, human rights activists need to reconceptualize and reframe the struggle. This is what happened in Palestine with the birth of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement in 2005. The movement has adopted a human rights framework. Yet instead of deploying human rights to solve isolated legal cases in colonial courts, the BDS movement mobilizes human rights in order to challenge the existing structure of domination. In sharp contrast to professional human rights NGOs, the BDS movement is homegrown, the product of Palestinian society. Its aim is to develop international solidarity and mobilize international popular support. It deploys human rights alongside anti-racist, anti-colonial, and anti-apartheid discourses. Thus, while the movement uses human rights in a way that many professionals would reject, it has managed to reframe the debate on Israel-Palestine and to establish a growing alliance among Palestinians, Israeli, and international political forces. If reconceptualized in these ways, human rights can still be mobilized for emancipatory purposes. Indeed, they can help create new political commitments based on justice and egalitarianism rather than propping up and oiling various apparatuses of injustice. Thank you very much.
Would you like to join here? Thank you very much, Professor Gordon. We have 25 minutes for your questions, and hopefully we'll have a lively debate. So who would like to get us started? Yes. You left everyone speechless.
Convinced.
Yes, please.
So maybe the way forward is to take the focus off the human rights language itself, but bring much more focus on the tests of the application of those human rights. So how do we test the true legitimacy of applying human rights? Is that not a way of doing it? Because in the same way that, you know, numerous political left and right groups have applied God is on my side principle before, human rights is on my side can be unequal. So surely there's a test for equality of application here that we need to do. I have no idea how to do that. You're the expert.
Okay, I'll take two more if there are any more questions.
I can begin when people want.
Let's see. Okay, let's begin by the response.
I don't think that solved the problem, and I'll give you an example. So we have the French Declaration of the Rights of Man, and there's four central rights in the French Declaration of the Rights of Man, and one of these central rights is the right to property, okay? So you're saying, let's examine the application of the right to property and see, and that will be the test. But what is the right to property? So there began a debate after the French Revolution about what the right to property means. There was a camp that said, this is my pen, and I have a right to it. And if you take this pen from me, then you're violating my right. And then there was another camp that said, no, that's not what the meaning of the right to property is. The meaning of the right to property is that I have to have a job so I can earn money, so I can get property, which is a totally different meaning. I should be employed is the right to property, okay? And the right to employment. That is the politics of human rights. It's the interpretation of what this right means, and only then you can judge its application. So here, as you saw, the Jews, the Israeli Jews, are saying that they are the victims, and the Palestinians are saying that they are the victim. And the politics is this struggle over who is the victim of the violation, and only when that is determined can we check the application. Only after we determine what the interpretation is. So the Bedouins in those villages that I showed pictures of say that there or next to the demolished home say their rights are violated, and that's the application as you saw it. And Regavim will say that was a case of law enforcement, And that was a case of justice, that demolition, okay? So the application doesn't help us. It's how we first interpret the right, and that's where the struggle is.
So I'll ask a couple, do you ever think the pursuit of human rights will be apolitical? And I suppose it kind of links to the second one.
Be apolitical?
Yeah, be non-political, because if politics or economics is how we distribute resources, there'll always be some kind of bias in that, I suppose. But maybe ignore that. If my right to speak now or to peace puts a responsibility on everyone here to allow me to speak and to not shout in my face, surely rights will only exist where people agree to share those responsibilities. And will that ever work where it's decreed from above, or will it have to be based on a more common law system? And that's why it's failing in Israel, Palestine, where there's no common law basis.
Well, first, to your first question, I don't think there's anything ever apolitical. I think everything is political. And so I don't think it's desirable to be apolitical, and I don't think it's possible to be apolitical. Often the political, people say you're subjective or you're political when you're not saying something that is commonsensical to everyone, you're not saying something that is the norm among everyone. But the norm is political, okay? So, for example, heterosexual relationships are considered the norm, and therefore they're considered non-political. And gay relationships are considered political. But both are political in the same way. I don't know if that's the best example. As to your other question, no, I don't think, again, that Israel, I'm not sure that it's a question of common. You see, there's constantly, and there's something even probably good about it, there's constantly, across space and time, a struggle over the meaning and the interpretation of words. And human rights is words. And so if you look today at the United States, you have a Supreme Court and you have a constitution, supposedly a common law. But the Supreme Court, it depends who's president and who chooses the judges, that's how they interpret whether they're for abortion or against abortion, whether abortion is a human right or it's not a human right. And they're supposedly, what they're doing is they're looking at the Constitution and saying what the Constitution says. But the Constitution, there is no Constitution before interpretation. We always reach the text. We can never reach a text before its interpretation. We always interpret. And the politics is already the act of interpretation. So it's always going to be political.
International common law in the pursuit of better rights for people, not better than decrees from NGOs or the UN, I suppose the UN is international common law, or the pursuit of it.
Okay, maybe I will intervene in this conversation. Yes. Are there any more questions? Because I have a question I would like to pose as well. Yeah, I forgot to say, do you mind introducing yourselves when you're speaking?
I'm not a student. I am just an Italian tourist.
Okay.
And I come from London. And my English is not so good.
It's fine.
It's excellent.
I am just a citizen. And years ago in Italy, we speak a lot about the Palestinian situation. But I don't know here, but people now don't want anymore to hear about, because it's a fact happened there. Today we are a little bit sad because they killed them every day. We saw a lot of docufilm about what happened there, one English or docufilm, what happened to bring the children to school. So, and we know that there's a situation where they take the land, and then, so and in the one film they said God is not a person who speaks about land. So the situation is so terrible. And here I heard last year conference about United Nations responsible of Gaza camp, and he treats the Gaza camp like a normal village. The children go to school, so often that life is like this. So how do you think that your work, your study can change the political situation, because this is the end of the discussion. Things must change because political wants to do something.
Mm-hmm.
Now with Trump, the situation is more terrible. So what do you think, if there is some hope to change the situation, if there is a possibility, because mm-hmm. things are going worse and worse, no? What do you think?
I think, I mean, it's a big question.
No, just
there's going to have to be a struggle from below, and there's going to have to be pressure from outside. And the world today is unwilling to pressure Israel to make any changes due to a variety of reasons. There's the alliance between the United States and Israel. There's the Islamophobia in Europe that strengthens Israel, because Israel is against the Islam, and so forth. So I think, but if you're asking what can do, is it has to do through mobilization from below and pressure from above. And until these two things happen, and I don't think they're going to happen in the near future, not much is going to change, unfortunately.
I have a theoretical question.
Yes.
I can ask it in two ways. In general terms, why are you, if human rights and domination are so intimately connected, why are you trying to salvage human rights? And in particular, your third proposal for salvaging human rights, you gave the example of the BDS movement. If human rights need the supplement of an additional discourse, whether anti-racism, anti-colonialism, or what you gave some other examples, then why stick to human rights if it is in need of these supplementary discourses? Why not move forward with an anti-colonial or anti-racist discourse, for example?
We have a problem, and our problem is that basically we think of human rights as a discourse that's been around forever. It hasn't been around forever. It starts with the liberal tradition, probably around Locke's time, but it really manifests itself much, much later, post probably World War II, as a powerful discourse. Now, our problem is that to create a discourse that becomes kind of commonsensical and that people can use is not an easy task. And there aren't many discourses like that around. And so in a way, my response in the end is the response of the lazy. Because, or the response of someone that doesn't have the intellectual capacity to give an adequate response. And the adequate response would have to be to start thinking of new discourses that in a way reflect conceptions of justice. So if you read the Bible or the New Testament or the Quran, there's no human rights there, but they talk about justice all the time. Okay, that's what these texts are about. So there is a lot, there are many ways to talk about justice that are not human rights. And I think human rights have gained a certain kind of universal or global capital that it becomes easy to use them. Rather than saying, okay, let's try to invent something new. And something new takes years also to invent. It's not something that from today to tomorrow. Sometimes it takes 100 years or 200 years for it kind of to coalesce into something that can be used. Now, what is interesting about the BDS is that it understands, it uses human rights with an understanding of the limits of human rights. So it's not going to take the human rights discourse and go to the Israeli High Court of Justice and demand justice, because for the proponents of BDS, the High Court of Justice is a colonial court and will always ultimately judge with the colonizer and not with the colonized. So there's no point to go to the... So it's using it differently. And by using it differently, it might be also changing it a bit, the discourse itself and the meaning we... I'm not sure this is the best solution. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know... And things also, this book was written before Trump. Mm-hmm. And things have changed. And today, you know, before Trump, it was very easy to criticize liberalism, human rights as liberal. After Trump, you're saying, hey, maybe we need some tools against Trump, and maybe liberalism could be a tool. But then you say to yourself, but maybe liberalism is what created the Trump. You know, so you're in a kind of mesh that is, you have to kind of slowly, and I don't really have fast answers, sorry.
I wasn't looking for a fast answer. Thank you. Any thoughts, reflections, questions? Yes.
Yes. With the West, it seems, are very fast to go in and have a go at all sorts of countries that they deem to be out of line. One thing that frustrates me is the inertia of the West in tackling Israel straight on about these violations. We all accept, I'm pretty sure, in this room, that there are violations going on. You know,
I'm not sure, but doesn't matter.
Fine. Well, you know, that's my proposition anyway.
Okay.
That there are human violations going on. Where does that inertia come from? Where is that race into Afghanistan, race into other places to try and change things? But there's a full stop when it comes to Israel.
No, it's a fascinating question, and again, one that I've thought about for many years. You have a colonial project which kind of violates, and yet you have the support of the West for it. And there's many reasons for this. I don't think you can say X, Y, and Z. There is, as I mentioned before, to her that so at this moment there's a convergence with Islamophobia and the anti-immigration in Europe, okay, or the Muslim ban in Trump. So around this convergence, Israel is the villa in the jungle of these the sea of Muslims. It's considered. you kind of see an alliance of Western values, supposedly. And you have to remember also that all these Western countries that were colonizers before, okay, they were all part of, they did this same, you know, and there's more and more, there's ties, there's networks, there's many, many reasons, but it is nonetheless confounding. It is not, and then there is this Judaea, like for example, they opened the embassy yesterday. And one of the speakers there is what's called a dispensationalist. You know what dispensationalist is? They believe that the Jews need to live in the Holy Land for the return of Christ. But when Christ returns, they all have to convert to Christianity or be killed. So he's basically an anti-Semite, okay? But he gives a talk at the embassy, okay? Because it's a certain thing that, and so you see these kinds of unholy alliances between different, and he's a Zionist. He's a Zionist because he thinks that Jews should control the land for the return of Christ. Okay? So it's this, you see these, I don't know how to call them, kind of weird things going on in the world where where it's unexpected, and these kind of alliances. It's also this Zionist Christian alliance also goes back to the Balfour Declaration. I mean, it's not something new, and it manifests itself differently in different periods and with different but it nonetheless, with even detecting these kind of relationships, I think the question still stands. It's still a powerful question. How is it, given what just happened yesterday, everyone's quiet? But then we see that everyone's, you know, 400,000 or how many people have been killed in Syria? Half a million almost. And Yemen, what's going on today? I mean, it's devastating what's going on in the Middle East, and very little.
One of the part of that base of that question was the Myanmar. Just talking about Nick Clinton, whereas it has been suggested that there's a bit of ethnic cleansing going on in Israel. You know, yet, you know, we're jumping on the Myanmar immediately straight away and waving flags, but there's a full stop, there's a halt. The suggestions there, I'm not suggesting that that is what is happening, but you hear the suggestion, but there's a full stop, there's a block. You know,
where? With the Rohingya?
Keep your hands off. Yeah.
Rohingya is clearly a case of ethnic cleansing. I mean, there are people that are saying that it's worse, but it's clearly a case of ethnic cleansing. And
any other questions, thoughts? Yep.
You talk about the sort of elitism around human rights and the deprofessionalization of it, and also about the need for pressure from above as well as pressure from below. Where do you see the pressure from above coming in a sort of deprofessionalized, de-NGOized human rights environment?
I meant pressure from outside, not above. And the way I think it would work is that it has to come from below. It has to come from below, but it's a kind of, it works like that. So the idea is that the BDS movement, for example, as a pressure from inside and outside, so the BDS movement goes to civil society in different countries in the West, mobilizes civil society, the grassroots. They put pressure on their politicians, and their politicians put pressure on Israel. Okay, or they put pressure on their corporations and their poor corporations. So it was a mistake. I did say above, it was a mistake. It's a process that has to begin from below, both in Israel and outside of Israel. But then it can move upwards. It has to move upwards in order to pressure. So a corporation decides, or the pension funds. One way the students in the United States are operating, they're asking their universities, our pension funds are invested in the stocks, to invest in stocks that are unrelated to Israel. Now that's a lot of money, pension funds of all the faculty in the United States, or pensions of the faculty in the UK. So that becomes a grassroots that goes up, uses the financial markets to put pressure. Okay? Something of the sort.
Okay, last question, Eva?
The interpretation of? In a global, like, as a society who understands what is happening in Israel and in other faraway countries, like the message behind undermining human rights as an institution can be harmful in certain aspects because there's a sort of solidarity and global empathy towards these cases which can in a way be shifted, perhaps not for the good. And so maybe there's a way of preventing that. Of course it would be an education of the public understanding, and I wonder if that could be a way of perhaps like solving the problem of the professionalization as well.
But you don't know what language, what discourses human rights is erasing. So we've chosen a discourse, we've chosen a language with which to interpret the injustices. This language I've tried to claim is problematic for many reasons, and I could go on and on. It's much more problematic than I said. For example, it's a language that constitutes those that use it as individual bearer of rights. So it kind of undermines the creation of collectivities and communities. It does a lot of other things that's problematic. And what we don't know, if this language was tomorrow erased from our heads, you know, something happened to the computer and erased it, I would assume that other languages would take its place, and they might be better. They might convey the plight of the Palestinians or the plight of the underdog, the plight of those that are oppressed, dispossessed, in a better way. Maybe the tools they'll give those that use them a better way. I talked the other day with someone that was an anti-apartheid activist in South Africa during the late 80s, early 90s in South Africa. And she says there were no posters of human rights. They used a different language.